And the next speaker is Michael Frank from University of Florida, speaking about reversible computing, quantum computing's practical cousin.
Okay. The title of this talk is meant to be a little bit provocative. Now, before I start, let me say I like quantum computing as much as the rest of you. I've been following the field for about 9 years now, and I don't mean to say that quantum computing will never be practical for some applications, but what I am going to try to convince you is that even a more plain vanilla type of thing called reversible computing actually, in and of itself, may have more ultimate practical applications for the majority of computing. And this is mainly for thermodynamics reasons. As you know, and as we've seen in plenty of the previous talks, there are a lot of difficulties in the physical implementation of quantum computing, maintaining coherence scalably over large-scale systems, being able to do large numbers of quantum operations without decoherence. And that difficulty comes from this need to maintain coherence. But in reversible computing, we don't need to maintain coherence except in an approximate local sense that's needed for physical reversibility. So we avoid that whole set of problems associated with maintaining full global coherence. And yet, we can show that there are completely general purpose applications in computing for doing things reversibly. Essentially, speed-ups and improvements in practical cost efficiency of computing that just come out of thermodynamic reversibility. And one thing that I've been working on lately is quantifying these insights based on detailed models of physical models of computing at the nanoscale and projecting them into the future using Moore's law predictions and known limits on capabilities like the size and energy efficiency of traditional irreversible logic to predict what is the cost efficiency benefit that we get from reversibility in the long run. And one of my recent analyses came up with the prediction that we should be able to get cost factors of at least 1,000 improvement in cost efficiency for reversible computing by the middle of this century. And as a result, I think that this is an area that deserves more study. I think among the academic community, to some extent, reversible computing is seen as less theoretical and therefore less interesting than quantum computing, but from the industry's perspective, it's still pretty far out research. And so I'm in this middle ground where it's sort of not a mainstream academic thing like quantum computing is becoming, and yet it's not something that industry is interested in for practical purposes. It's somewhere in between, and I think we need more people to fill this gap in this in-between area. So I'll start out comparing reversible computing with quantum computing. Talk a little bit about some of the fundamental physical limits on computing, which go into the models that I build. And then I'll talk about some simple mechanical and conceptual models of reversible computing, and then talk about how I analyze the benefits of reversible computing for future nanocomputing. And the conclusion will be basically that reversible computing is a good area to be in, at least for someone like me who wants to have a near-term, or relatively near-term engineering impact. This I'm not going to spend too much time on because we've already had plenty of talks that cover the nature of decoherence and irreversibility earlier in this conference. But I just want to remind everyone of this point that one way to view quantum theory is that it's doing something unitary, something that's reversible at microscale all the time in, quote, reality, right? But conserving space, as Dr. Levinson mentioned. But since we cannot perfectly model the quantum evolution of a system as it interacts with another external system that whose state may be unknown, or if it interacts according to some interaction that's not completely known with full precision, then the effective amount of entropy in our knowledge of the state of the system can increase over time. And so that's what leads to the phenomenon of irreversibility, decoherence, apparent wave function collapse, and so forth. Now, as we all know, with quantum computing, we have to have coherent states to get speedups of quantum algorithms, global coherent states, and yet this is a problem for physical implementations. One other aspect of quantum computing that's found in most quantum computing models, both physical and theoretical, is that you envision the system as being operated on by some mechanism, some control mechanism that's external to that system, which is often viewed as a classical external system, although we saw one talk earlier today about having a quantum controller as well. And this is something that I argue is going to be needed in the long run, that we need to have completely self-contained models of systems in which we account for energy dissipation and irreversibility, not only in the system being controlled, but also in the controlling system. And you have to do that in order to reduce total overall energy dissipation. So, but we're not doing this yet in quantum computing. And yet we only get this advantage for a relatively small set of problems. I mean, the total world market for computing is vast, and only a minuscule part of that has to do with any of the applications of quantum computing that have been discovered so far. Now, in contrast, in reversible computing, we don't need to maintain global coherence. You need some amount of coherent transitions between states. You need stable or pointer states for the system in order to stably encode information. And transitions between states have to be able to carry out coherently as well in order to avoid entropy generation. But we don't need to maintain global coherence of the whole system, and therefore we don't need to apply the quantum algorithms for fault tolerant and error correction and so forth, which add a lot of overhead if you want to actually build a functioning quantum computer. So you can say you can use ordinary signal restoration techniques and ordinary classical error correction if needed, and so you don't have as many scaling problems. And the reason we can get away with this is that the goal of reversible computing is purely the low entropy generation in computing. And I've discovered through a number of analyses that this indirectly leads to speed up of the graphic computation at a large scale, because essentially you're reducing the rate at which energy is dissipated per operation. And so you can increase the number of operations you can do per unit time at a given power level, or within an enclosure of a given area that has limits on its heat flux. So, and these advantages are completely general. They apply to any computing application whatsoever, as long as it's not a fully serial model in which you don't have any parallelism, and so you don't have any problem with heat dissipation, and if the cost of energy were free, then you wouldn't care about energy dissipation. Or, on the other hand, if you had an extremely loosely coupled parallel algorithm, the processors don't have to be close together. You can spread them out over a large area. And again, if energy happens to be free, then you don't get any advantage from reversibility. But the majority of real-world computational problems have optimal algorithms that are somewhere in between these two extremes. They're not fully serial, and they're not totally loosely coupled parallel problems. And so there's some advantage to packing things closer together with a smaller surface area around the whole system. And so there's some advantage to be gained if you can do more operations per unit time at a given level of power dissipation. This is, I guess, a little blurry and hard to read, but this slide is just comparing in one chart the requirements for quantum computing and reversible computing. Basically, in a quantum computer, we need global unitary transformation to be implemented. We need to maintain global coherence, and locally you at least maintain coherence within a threshold of about 10 to the 4, which actually recently been reduced to 10 to the 3rd quality factor in order to apply fault tolerant algorithms. And in both quantum and reversible computing, the system needs to operate nearly adiabatically, that is, nearly thermodynamically reversibly. And for reversible computing, we don't care about global coherence, but one thing we do care about is that the model of the control for the system be integrated into our model for the whole system. And why is that important? It's because if we care about the energy dissipation of the whole system, we have to worry about what's happening in the controller. We can't just send control pulses that are generated according to some arbitrary pattern we want and not worry about what's happening with the energy dissipation and generating those pulses. Also, even if you imagine that you can get benefits by just externalizing these control systems, and removing energy dissipation from the internals of the system, there's some issues with whether signals can scalably be introduced from outside throughout a large, say, three-dimensional volume as it grows. And so I'm going to look at mechanisms of control and synchronization that are completely local so that there are no scaling problems going up to larger scales. And finally, we need the system to essentially evolve under its own momentum forward through the computational configuration space rather than being actively driven from outside. And some early models of reversible computing didn't have this property, and so they were not especially high performance. If we want high performance, we need forward evolution. And this is something that we don't necessarily need in quantum computing. We can have the system just sit statically in one state whenever we're not actively driving at it with a, say, an RF pulse. Okay, so now comes my whirlwind tour of fundamental physical limits of computing. This is my big chart summarizing everything here. These basic principles of quantum theory and relativity turn out to apply in various combinations, limits on important quantities of information processing. So for example, the communications latency over given distance is determined by the speed of light. The information capacity for a system of given size and energy, as Warren Smith here and others have shown, is limited by quantum mechanics together with the quantum definition of energy, limited by an uncertainty principle and the definition of energy. So for a system of given information capacity, since there are limits on information capacity for a system of given size, and there's a speed of light limit on propagation, there's a limit on information bandwidth, the rate at which information can flow through an area. So if you imagine a system with information encoded at maximum density, moving at some velocity that has to be less than the speed of light, you get limit on information bandwidth. Similarly, you also get limits on memory access time to a large memory. You can't have even time access to a memory whose size is increasing for random access. Margolis and Levitin a while back showed that the definition that in quantum mechanics, if you look at the consequences of a system having limited total energy, there's immediately an impact on the maximum processing rate in terms of number of operations per unit time, where operations are defined as transformations that can take a state to an orthogonal state. And finally, from basic thermodynamics, you can show there's limits on energy loss for operation, and I'll describe that limit in more detail. That's Landauer's principle in a couple of slides. Also, the adiabatic theorem tells you something about the scaling of energy loss per operation. So, unfortunately, I don't have time to go into detail into the theoretical justifications for all these, but at this point, they're pretty well understood. One thing I wanted to mention, which is sort of an aside, it's a hobby of mine in a sense, is in thinking about the limits that physics places on computing, it also raises some interesting thoughts about how you can understand physical quantities themselves in terms of computational ones. And we've already talked about entropy a lot. And if you make a loose definition of information as just essentially logarithm of the total number of states in a physical system, a little broader definition of information than you were using, then entropy is just that part of the information, the physical information in the system, that is unknown information. And Zurek has recently suggested extending this to also include incompressible information, which is effectively entropy, since the only sensible thing you can do with it is emit it from a system to the outside in something that's irreducible and analogous to the traditional concept of entropy. You can also view it as a way of looking at the information in a correlated system from the point of view of one of the four, being one of the correlated systems that knows something about the other system. So we measure entropy or information in units that are logarithmic in the number of states, and if you use a natural log, then it gets you Boltzmann's constant as your unit of entropy or information, or if you use log base 2, you get the bit as a unit of entropy or information. One thing that Popley suggested a while back, and then some people have been looking at in more detail lately, is that the concept of action can be interpreted as a number of quantum operations that occur in manipulating some system, where you count the number of operations in terms of the number of, say, quantum logic gates that have the capability of changing a state to an orthogonal state. So, for example, if you have an operation that takes a spin up and will translate to a spin down, that goes to an orthogonal state, so that would count as one operation. Now, that operation doesn't necessarily take all input states to an orthogonal state. So, for example, if you start out with a state at, you know, an angle of 45 degrees, you rotate that spin around, you get another state that's not orthogonal to the original one, if you just use a, you know, 180-degree rotation of the spin. But we still consider it an operation, even though it doesn't orthogonalize all states. Why is that? Well, the classical concept of an operation doesn't necessarily require that the state change on all possible inputs. So, for example, if you perform an AND operation or a Toffoli gate on two bits and use that to change a third bit, well, you know, if the two bits are not 1-1, then the state is not going to change. Right? It's only in a case where the input bits were 1-1 that the state of the third bit actually changes. So the general concept of computational operation is one that's at least changes the state to distinguishable one some of the time. So you can measure the number of quantum operations that take place along a trajectory through state space, for instance, a sequence of quantum logic gates, by adding up the number of ops associated with each quantum logic gate. And we'll see in a minute that one understanding of energy lets you then interpret action as number of operations that are involved in carrying out motion and interaction between particles. I don't have time to go into detail through all the rest of these. Angular momentum can be considered a number of operations associated per unit angle of rotation. Proper time, distance, and time could potentially be defined as number of operations associated with translation of some reference system along a given trajectory. And this might be a Planck mass particle if you believe the predictions of some quantum gravity theories that say that there's a fixed length scale or energy scale at Planck mass or Planck energy, and that this is something that's independent of reference. So, anyway, there's not time. I could spend a whole talk just on this stuff. It's very interesting to me. But now, energy, one consequence of the Margolis-Levitin theorem, which says that essentially the maximum rate at which a quantum system can change state is limited by its energy, its average energy. Well, one interpretation of that result is just that energy fundamentally is just counting the total rate of computation that's taking place within a system. If you measure computational operations as essentially the possibility of changing one state to an orthogonal state. Now, whether a given input state actually goes to an orthogonal state or not depends on what that input state is. But the idea of energy is that if it's distributed in an optimal way, then states change at the rate given by that balance. So this is very interesting. And I'm not going to go through all of this, but one more thing is that temperature, if energy is interpreted as rate of quantum computation that's happening in a system, and entropy, for example, is the number of bits of state of unknown information, then temperature is just the average rate of change per bit in the part of the system whose state is unknown. And you can separate this into thermal temperature for parts of the system whose state is unknown, and generalized temperature for the whole system, even parts of the state is known. You can ascribe a sort of a generalized temperature to even zero entropy parts of the system. So anyway, that's all very interesting, and in fact, it's inspired some of the models I've come up with and some of the results I've come up with. But let me now go into more detail on some of the motivations for reversible computing in particular. The inspiration for this field came out of Landauer's discovery in 1961 his proof that irreversible operations necessarily cause energy dissipation. And you can prove that Landauer's principle just using basic facts of quantum theory. So, for example, if you start out with an ensemble here of small box here is the state of a digital bit that's encoded in the machine. This cloud represents the state of everything else in the system. There's some number of possible states, distinguishable states for the rest of the system, for each value that the digital bit can have. But because quantum evolution is fundamentally unitary at a low level, each one of these possible distinguishable input states has to map to a distinguishable output state after that evolution. And so if the value of this digital bit is being unconditionally changed to being always zero, no matter whether it was zero or one originally, then that means there has to be essentially twice as many distinguishable states now in the rest of the environment besides the digital bit we're concerned with. And if we're not tracking, we're not keeping track of what happens with that information, then it's essentially unknown, it's incompressible, it has to be considered entropy, and so the entropy has increased by log of 2, and as a result there's an increase in, there's a loss of energy to heat of that KT object. So that's Landauer's principle. Very easy way to understand it, in my view. So now, Charlie Dynevac here proposed in 1973, well look, we can just do computations in an entirely reversible way and avoid that Landauer bound. So let's now look at some models for doing that. This slide is unreadable. I just wanted to put this up here. This is a list of objections to Charlie's proposal, reasons why reversible computing will never work, that have been proposed by various people. And every single one of them has been refuted, okay, at one point or another. Okay, so there's a history of people saying, oh, this sounds too good to be true, so there must be something wrong with it. But no one's ever found anything wrong with it with a really logically valid argument. And counterexamples keep getting invented that say why each of the previous skeptical arguments was wrong. So let me go into some models now of how reversible computing works. Landauer's original model was this picture where you have a system with some generalized coordinate here in this configuration space and a potential energy surface in that coordinate. All right? And if there are two wells in this potential energy surface separated by some barrier, then you can store a bit of information in some stable ground states within each of those potential energy wells. All right? So there's a natural bit for you when you can assign 0 and 1 to these states. Now, suppose we can actually adjust the potential energy well through some external control, and I'll talk about how to make the external control internal later. We can adjust the height of the potential energy barrier relative to the bottom of the well, or we can apply a bias force to the whole system and change the relative height of these left and right points here. Just provide, add a little more potential onto this curve. So, for purposes of my discussion, I'm going to distinguish six states of this potential energy surface that are qualitatively different. There's, of course, smooth variations in between these, but I'm going to focus just on these six discrete states, where we have a barrier raised, barrier lowered, we have neutral bias to the left, and bias to the right. Now, it turns out we can understand all of the classical and reversible computing mechanisms that have been proposed so far roughly in terms of this paradigm, although quantum computing approaches are not interesting. Here's a simple mechanical model of how you could physically implement the Landauer paradigm. Here we have two rods here, and this one can move up and down, this one can move left or right. This one has a knob sticking out underneath it, which is on the same plane as this wedge that's sticking up from the back rod. These are mechanical springs here. Now, if you can push either on the right end or on the left end of this rod, you'll compress the springs and this knob will move a little bit to the left or right. That's applying your bias force. You can physically move this rod up or down. That will contact this knob here and push it farther to the left or to the right. That's raising your potential energy barrier. Because when this wedge is up, the knob has to be either on one side or the other of it, and there's a very high barrier to tunneling across that. So here's a simple way to visualize Landauer's model mechanically. Now, once you have this model and you distinguish these different states of the energy well, it's easy to list all of the possible adiabatic transitions between states of the surface. Okay? So you can adiabatically, you can change the bias force when the barrier is lowered. adiabatically, change the bias scores. But there are certain operations that are not adiabatic, such as, for example, when the one well has higher energy than the zero well, and the bit is located in the one well, if you remove that barrier, then you have that irreversible transition to this the lower energy state here, and some emission of heat in that. So once you write this down, it becomes easy to look at various paradigms for logic and storage of information in terms of these transitions. Now, all classical irreversible logic, like we use in all of our computers today, in their CMOS-based transistor logic, take this approach. They just don't care about this dissipation. They'll lower a potential energy barrier between two states. In other words, they'll turn on the transistor connecting two nodes at different voltages, and energy will be dissipated in that transition. So that's well and good. You can do logic by using a series of parallel combinations of barriers between a long trajectory and states, and that's fine. And for memory, we do things like apply a bias force, for instance, to a DRAM cell, raise a potential energy barrier, in other words, close off some transistor, and then remove the bias force. And now we've got information stored in the position of your system in one of the two states. And, you know, if you do careful design, you can arrange so that when you lower this barrier sufficiently slowly, the dissipation could be made as low as the Landauer bound, in this case, KT12. But normally, we aren't that careful in this, actually. It ends up being much higher than that. So how can we do logic and memory reversible? Well, we can understand that just by looking at different ways to follow trajectories through this space. So here's something, a paradigm I call input bias clock barrier logic. So data comes into a cell applying the bias force, the leftward, rightward force on the system. All right, so we move it into the 0 or 1 state. Then a timed clock signal, which is data independent, comes in and raises the potential energy barrier between those states. Okay, this, so far it's the same as we were doing in irreversible memory. Then we retract the input, the state goes back to having no bias, and yet we have a distinction between these states. Now, the key point to notice here is that to get rid of this information, the only way to do it is not just to lower this barrier. Instead, we can undo the whole sequence of operations around here. If we have another copy of the input available, and return that memory to a neutral state in a fully adiabatic fashion. And there are several, let me see the side of the screen there. Change modes. Okay, now I can see it. There have been several specific mechanisms for doing adiabatic logic that use exactly this paradigm, input bias clock barrier paradigm. These include adiabatic quantum dot cellular automata that the Notre Dame group proposed, a CMOS-based technique called SQL that was used at MIT, Drexler's rod logic latch way back in his nanosystems book in 92, used the same mechanism for reversible storage. Dr. Lipperitz's parametric quantron logic was essentially the same paradigm, if I remember. Maybe you can correct me on that or comment. And Merkle invented a mechanical technique called problem logic. But they basically all use this paradigm. And you can do logic here by adding together forces that perturb the system before you raise one of these barriers. You can do majority logic. Here's a different paradigm for doing a reversible logic. This one is limited to only being able to do combinational logic, and it sort of inverts the role of the two influences on the potential energy well. I call this input barrier clock bias logic because the data-dependent input determines whether or not the barrier is raised between the two 0 and 1 states. And then a data-independent clock force comes along and biases the system to the other side. So the system either changes state or not, depending on whether the barrier is raised. And this is nice because you can do logic very easily by having a series of parallel arrangements of potential energy barriers, like we do in ordinary CMOS logic gates. But the problem is that, notice that you can't remove the potential energy barrier here without dissipation until you've retracted the input. So this is called retractile cascade logic because essentially you can perform a long sequence of combinational logic operations, but then if you want to adiabatically reuse that circuit, you have to then undo all of those operations in the reverse order before you can apply a new input reversibly to the system. So that approach is kind of limited. After coming up with this way of looking at the whole problem, I came up with a new technique, which I call input barrier clockwise latching, which kind of combines the best of both worlds. Instead of conditionally raising the potential energy barrier, when the input comes in, it conditionally lowers the barrier. So in other words, the normal state of the barrier is to be always raised. When the input comes in, it lowers the barrier between the states. Then we have a clock bias force here, which conditionally puts the bit at the core. But then when the input is removed, the barrier is unconditionally raised. It's never lowered. And so it locks in the state change into the distinction between these two states. And you can immediately then retract the clock bias. Now you've got a bit of information stored in here. You've done some logic in generating that bit of information. And now you don't have to use this retractile approach. You can actually do sequential logic with feedback. And this is what we did in our circuits at MIT. So based on some of these insights and some other things, here's a sort of a sketch of a full classical mechanical model of reversible computing that has a lot of desirable properties. It's parallelizable in three dimensions with local interactions to arbitrarily large sizes, limited by leakage power, but other than that, scalable to arbitrarily large sizes. It supports fully pipelineable, reversible logic, sequential circuits with feedback. There is no asymptotic slowdown compared to ideal reversible circuits such as circuits built with Copley gates. It's stable. There's no chaotic instabilities in it. It doesn't require any fancy quantum stuff, and so basically gives us everything we want. We have these ballistically rotating flywheels. We have rods moving around. We have these meshes interlocking these flywheels together in three dimensions. And am I almost out of time already? Okay. So let me skip around a little bit. I'm actually looking at mechanical techniques for doing this using MEMS resonator technologies, which have now gotten to an extremely good quality where you can get queues of 10,000 frequencies and hundreds of megahertz. So I'm looking at this, combined electromechanical logics. This is just a sketch of some logic paradigms that I've come up with, but I'll skip through those. We can go through them in more detail afterwards if you're interested in it. Here are the chips we built at MIT that actually used fully reversible logic styles that were pipelineable to do arbitrary computation. This is an array of simple one-bit processors. This is a full RISC-style microprocessor that uses entirely reversible logic. So there are no architectural barriers to being able to do things reversibly. And finally, since I don't have much time, let me just get through to the results of the last analysis where I take into account a bunch of real-world costs in computing, a bunch of areas of modeling, such as consideration of synchronization problems, heat dissipation, and so forth, include a bunch of factors in the model, like the slowdown associated with adiabatic operation, the overheads of reversible logic, the limited quality factors in real devices, and so forth. And I guess I don't have time for the detailed model. This is a sketch of the reversible algorithm model we used, which was based on another technique by Charlie Bennett. And we had some scaling trends for the energy entropy generation per operation, the size of devices, and so forth. some other fixed assumptions, which are all sort of reasonable constant limits on what you can tolerate in sort of a desktop scale computer. And the end result of all this is that reversible computing is not more cost efficient now for general purpose computing, but in about 10 years it starts to pull away from irreversible computing, becomes increasingly more beneficial. Essentially, as devices get cheaper, we can pack in more of them, heat dissipation becomes more of a limited concern. And depending on whether we use Bennett's 1989 algorithm to emulate arbitrary irreversible computations, or we have some optimized computation that's been hand-coded to be highly efficient on a reversible machine, we get somewhere between 1,000 and 100,000 times improvement in cost efficiency by the middle of the century, based on Moore's law trends and minimum limits. I'll skip these last two slides. So the conclusion here is that reversible computing is something, there's some relations to quantum computing and some common requirements, but it's much easier to accomplish. It has enormous practical real-world benefits for the majority of computing. It's been somewhat slow to catch on, maybe because it's not as interesting to physicists as quantum computing sort of thing, but I believe that as a result of these general purpose benefits, reversible computing is actually more likely to become sort of the foundation for computer engineering towards the end of this century.
Questions, please? Yes.
Yes.
In the beginning of the talk, you mentioned about the irreversibility which is related to quantum measurement as our inability to keep the information about the integrity. If we believe it is principle impossibility, or it's just technical inability. In principle, there is irreversibility is pretty easy.
In principle, if I understand you correctly, you're asking if the problem of principle or practice that you can't track the state of the system. Well, I believe that it's essentially a problem in the principle that you can't do it whenever you have. You know, it'll always interact to some degree with an unknown external environment. But in principle, if you have complete knowledge of a closed quantum system, then you know, if the entropy is initially zero, if it stays zero, you have perfect knowledge of how that system evolves over time. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
As a colleague in reversible computing, I would like to ask you to make an objection to know what kind of an answer you have.
Okay.
Suppose you want to ship a present to your girlfriend from here to Stanford. Gravitationally speaking, it's at the same level. So if the energy that you have to dissipate to the limit is zero.
Right.
However, to do that, to achieve that, you need to create a perfectly horizontal flat vacuum tunnel with night gravitation and something like that. And then you better have it on a scale. If I want to send this package, they would say, well, first of all, you wait 20 years until you meet the tunnel. Then you invest some money for this infrastructure.
Right.
Then you wait another 20 days because if we fill a whole container of presents for different girlfriends, then it will go.
Right.
And then it has to be, the slower you send it, the cheaper it is.
Right. But look, I understand.
The final thing is that winning, in terms of the winning evolution, I'm perfectly happy to spend somebody else's gasoline, you know, it's gasoline that we get from Iraq by mauling them or whatever. You know, I would get a present to my girlfriend by her birthday on Friday.
Look, I understand what you're saying in principle, that it just may not be cost effective to do it. But, you know, I've worked out the constant factors for, you know, various real technologies that exist. And, you know, believe me, it is cost effective. The cost of energy really is significant. The extra design time is not that great. The quality factors of devices you can build are high enough that, you know, I think these projections are realistic. I mean, they're not just pulled out of a hat. So, you know, sure, there are overheads for reversible computing, but the overheads are outweighed vastly by the advantages. And,
yes, please. On the question of counting operations versus rotations,
right,
to an orthogonal state. This seems like a
persistent difference in the way one looks at things in computer science and physics. Because, on the one hand, a very complicated process of computation requiring many operations is only a mapping from one state to an orthogonal state, that is, from the input to the output. And it's just because we don't know how to do it efficiently that we have to use many
operations. I should have said sort of local orthogonalizing operations. So going from the input state to the output state in one step would be a
non-local operation. Yeah, that's a very important distinction.
Yeah.
It was also raised, I think, by Landauer when he said, we don't consider a computer to be a computer if it's just a lookup table. The other thing complementary to that that you mentioned was that an operation is something that is capable of rotating a state to an orthogonal state. So when you apply an operation to some data, it might not do anything.
Right.
But I think it's just important to keep in mind the difference between rotating to an orthogonal state and doing an operation.
Right, but my argument was that, and this was actually something Seth Boyd pointed out to me, which is that even traditional classical logic gates that we think of as doing operations don't always
rotate. Right, this is not a classical quantum distinction. This is the difference between motion and wasted and useful motion.
Sure. Yeah, they're not necessarily useful operations.
Since you mentioned this at the moment, that sort of action, in agreement with what Charles is saying, it's better to count action, not as number of gates, but log of the number of possible paths.
Right, I understand that.
Because this way it gives you exactly a sensible count.
Okay, I'm afraid I should stop discussion. At this point, thank the speaker again.